Father, I thank you for the privilege we have of studying your word again, especially on this important topic of money management. And I pray that you'll bless us as we consider these topics this afternoon, that we'll be able to understand them and by your grace to put them into practice in our lives. In Jesus' name, amen. So we were actually in this page and I think ready for number 3. Is that right? Everybody's ready? We're in section 3, page 8 of the workbook. And did the ABC have workbooks for some of you that went out to get them during lunchtime? Okay, we're all set. I think there will be some more available, and maybe even after the meeting tonight if you need to get a book. Many people today have the goal in life of accumulating stuff. And I wanted to tell you that from the Christian perspective, our goal is to recognize that we're to glorify God. And I have this verse here, 1 Corinthians 10:31. It says, whether therefore you eat or drink or whatever you do, would that include the management of our money then? Yeah? How should it be done? To the glory of God. I'm just quoting that, but you all know it from your childhood. We're going to go on to another one here. This is pretty interesting because I found this statement, and I think it's very true. The tithe is the minimum testimony of our Christian commitment. Nowhere in the Bible does God suggest that less than a tenth is His. And we're going to talk a little bit more about tithe tomorrow morning, but I just wanted you to understand that. And by the way, if you have the book, I'd like for you to write down something under number 4 here, and that would be right in that position. Maybe just make a comma and put verse 11. Everybody knows what Malachi 3:10 says, but you know where God says, prove me now in this, if I won't open for you the windows of heaven and pour you out such a blessing you don't have room enough to receive it. But do you know what the next verse says? It says, I will rebuke the devourer for your sake. I just love that verse. I will rebuke the devourer for your sake. Wouldn't you like God to work on your behalf to rebuke the devourer? So that's one that you need to have there. Okay, we're going to look at a couple of other ones here. In just a few minutes, we're going to go to lesson 5. We're going to skip lesson 4 and do it first thing tomorrow. And I want you to understand that from a biblical perspective, debt is bad. It is one of the most awesome, awful plagues among Christian families and people in the world today, period. Remember I told you in the first session this morning, 29,000 American families declared bankruptcy last year every week in America. 1.5 million families because of serious debt problems. Now, does anybody know without looking it up what Proverbs 22 verse 7 says? I learned this as a memory verse so I can quote it for you. It says, the borrower is the slave of the lender. That's the last part. But it says, the rich rule over the poor and the borrower is the slave or the servant of the lender. Do you believe that's true? It's really interesting how this happens, and I could tell you some stories about that, but I want to get into the debt thing. Suffice it to say that debt is bad. In fact, in the verse right before this, Proverbs 22 verse 6, it says, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he will not depart from it. And the very next verse is talking about how bad debt is. So you can understand why there's a connection there. Another one is that prosperity is having what you need when you need it. The idea about all of this is to understand that we should be happy with whatever God gives. Now, Philippians 4:19 says, my God will supply all of your needs according to his riches in Christ Jesus. And Matthew 28:20, you know, that's part of the Great Commission. Verse 19 says, go therefore and teach all nations and baptize them and teaching them to observe all the things that I've commanded you and baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. But what does verse 20 say? Lo, I am with you always. God has promised to be with us. And then Isaiah 26, verse 3. Most of you have memorized this as young people. And it says, thou wilt keep him in perfect peace whose mind is stayed on thee. So God's promised to supply our needs, to go with us where we go and give us peace in our lives. And those are real promises that we can count on. So I'm going to actually make some of these references later in the presentation, but I will just talk to you real quickly about Mark 8 right here. Being from Michigan, most of you have probably heard of Domino's Pizza. Tom Moynihan was the outright owner of more than 90% of the franchises. And at one time, he owned the Detroit Tigers baseball team. He had his own helicopter to fly him to the game so he didn't have to go in traffic. And he had his own yacht that was a big one, but according to the stories I've read of his testimony, he never did ride on it. But he had this big car collection. And he thought to his mind in rationalizing, since we have the largest pizza home delivery business in the world, it's rational for us to have a car collection. But you've probably read about his car collection. It was quite something. He had rare cars, for example. One of them was a 1931 Bugatti Royale that he had paid $11 million for, just one car. He had a whole warehouse full of these cars. And Tom tells in his testimony that one day that he was contemplating his life, and he thought, you know, if I keep going the way that I'm going now, I'm not sure it will lead me where I want to go. So he thought that he would accept the request of one of his friends to join a men's prayer group. And so he did. And every once a week they would meet on a certain morning, have a prayer and Bible study, and then have breakfast together like at a Holiday Inn or something. At any rate, he said, we were taking turns reading the Bible through. And one day when it was my turn, I read with a loud voice in front of all my business friends these verses. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what would a man give in exchange for his soul? And he said, I thought God put that right in the Bible for me. So you may know that he sold the Detroit Tigers. He sold his yacht. He sold his helicopter. He sold the car collection and put most of the money in Christian charity. And he sold Domino's Pizza in 1998 for $1 billion cash, which is an incredible thing. Again, most of the money going into Christian charity. He stated in his testimony that I heard, at first my wife thought I had lost my mind. But now we both know that there's nothing more important than heaven. Isn't that amazing? Quite an interesting testimony. So what we're going to do now is skip number 4 and go to session 5 in the book. And so I'm going to really just go to my little screen here where I can find it real quickly. And we'll look for it that way. Here it is. I have this little statement at the beginning of all of my sections so I know where to find them. And here we are on page 13. If you have the book, that's where we're going to be. This is session number 5. We'll ask the question, first of all, what is debt? Is an electric bill every month debt? No, not really. Debt is living today on money that you expect to earn in the future. And lots of people live that way. I'm going to tell you a short experience. Obviously, I'm not going to tell you anyone's name, but I taught a group of professional secretaries, 90 of them, my seminar, paid by their employer to come to it. 6 hours, 3 hours one day, and 3 hours another. And at the end of that time, one of the young ladies came to me and she said, I believe that my husband and I are in deep trouble. And I said, what do you mean? She said, well, a few months ago, we decided that we were going to buy our own furniture and get an unfurnished apartment so we could bring our stuff. They had newly married and they had rented a furnished apartment. So they saw this advertisement in the paper. You guys have seen this kind of thing where it said, if you buy furniture from us this week, it's on sale. And in addition to that, there's no payments or any interest for 6 months. Have you ever seen that kind of stuff? Well, I mean, that's the way it's mostly done. At any rate, I don't know if you guys have bought furniture recently, but furniture is quite expensive, actually. Our kids just both graduated from college in the last 5 years, so we're starting to replace our furniture. Not that it was that worn out, but I mean, just the colors we had didn't go with anything in the whole world. You understand? It's just the stuff we had for 20 years. It's just old. Well, anyway, she said they bought about $5,000 worth of furniture. I mean, you can buy a Lazy Boy recliner for almost $1,000. Does everybody understand that? I mean, it's not splurging. They got $5,000 worth of furniture. So anyway, she said, after coming to your seminar, she came to me a day or so afterward, my husband took out the contract to see when we had to start making payments. And he read the fine print this time on the back. And she said, our plan was to pay off the furniture in the 6 months because they were what we now call dinks. Has everybody heard that expression? Dinks. Dual income, no kids. You know, they got these lots of money coming in. And so these two dinks were going to pay off their furniture in 6 months. And she said anything we didn't have paid off, we were going to put on our credit card. But she said, when my husband got the contract out, it's due in 2 weeks. And we haven't paid anything on it. And in the meantime, we've maxed out our credit card. And then he also read that it's true there wasn't any payments or interest for 6 months. But if you didn't pay it off by that time, there was interest retroactive from the time you paid for it at like 21%. So there's like $1,000 worth of interest over that period of time. So they were in trouble. And I said, well, you know, did you have difficulty or something? Have you guys had some medical emergency? Your card is maxed out. And she said, oh no, she said, I'm a little bit embarrassed to tell you what we put on our card, but just think about this. I'm going to tell you some truisms right now. Even if you pay your credit card off every month, you know, not just minimum payment, but pay the whole thing off every month, you will still spend more if you use a credit card than if you use cash or a check. Isn't that amazing? You just buy more stuff. So she said, one evening my husband and I decided to go for a walk in the mall. And she said, we weren't really going to buy anything, but we made the mistake of stopping at the pet store. And this little puppy just fell in love with us, and we couldn't leave him there. That's what she said. And so she said they bought the puppy. And now I like dogs and cats, and we've had pets most of our married life, Kathy and I. But I want to tell you that pets cost a lot of money at these stores. It seems like it was like $480 they paid for this puppy. But of course you have to get him a place to lay down and a leash and all this other stuff. And then she said something real interesting to me. That went on the credit card, that stuff. And then she said, though we're vegetarians, my husband has always been fascinated by guns. And he belongs to some club where he gets magazines in the mail or whatever. And he saw this special rifle on sale. So he bought it. Now, when you have a gun, you don't just have a gun. You have to have a gun case to keep it locked up so that, you know, no one gets into it, you understand? And of course, you need ammunition and so on. All that stuff went on the credit card. Well, they were in trouble because debt is living today on money that you expect to earn in the future. The worst problem that dinks face is when one of them loses their job or the lady becomes pregnant and cannot continue working, and they've been living on two incomes, and then they're living on one. Big serious problems happen. But we're going to go on and look at some of these. We talked about bankruptcy already. Now, you're going to understand when you finish my seminar that I'm really down on debt. I think we should live debt-free if possible. Now, listen carefully. What I'm going to tell you in the next few sessions is ideal. We do not live in an ideal world. Everybody must understand that. But we want to be as close to the ideal as we can. Does that make sense? So that's what we're going to really talk about in the ideal world. Now, somebody always tells me this, so I'll tell you before someone here does. A guy came to me at the last camp meeting I went and said, Elder Reed, I have this capital idea. I believe that you're right about the end time stuff, and we really are near the end. But I think that you shouldn't be talking about getting out of debt so much. My idea is all of the Adventists ought to get cash advances on their credit cards and max out all their credit, get the money they can together, and get second mortgages on their house, and put all the money into the cause and finish the work. And then we can thumb our nose at the devil on the way to heaven, and he can pay off this debt during the millennium. Sounds pretty neat, doesn't it? The only problem is the Bible says that just before Jesus comes, there will be a time of trouble on this earth such as never was since there was a nation. And those who are in debt will have the worst time of it. It's really important to understand that. Somebody also says, well, you're so down on bankruptcy. Didn't you know they have bankruptcy in the Bible? And they frequently will quote this verse right here, Deuteronomy 15:1-2. Now, you know what it says. At the end of every 7 years, you shall forgive the debts. Now, since you can go bankrupt every 7 years, people mistakenly thought that was bankrupt. But who is the counsel given to in the Bible? It's not given to the guy who's in debt. It's given to the lender. Now, I'm going to give you an illustration of how this works. Assume for a moment that you guys are all bankers. You know how this works. I come to you and I want to get a loan. What's the first thing you ask me? What's your Social Security number? We want to see your credit history. And they can type it into the Equifax or TRW database, and guess what? Up comes every credit card that I'm approved for, every debt that I owe, and my car payments and my house payment and everything. You didn't think this was private, did you? You understand this stuff is out there. People understand. So they look at that, and let's just say that you're looking at my credit history. And you can see that I'm current on my house payments, and I have, you know, just a small balance on my credit card, and I'm working, and so on. Would you give me a loan? Sure. I'm a pretty good credit risk. But now let's make it one different, one little factor different. Let's pretend that we live in Bible times, and you're Bible bankers, okay? If 3 years of the seven-year cycle have already passed, once you approve my loan, how long would you give me to pay it back? Only the 4 years remaining. This simple Bible principle was put there by God to limit long-term indebtedness to 7 years. That's all it was. Listen carefully. The bankers are not stupid. They don't have the tallest buildings in town because they don't know what's going on. Do you understand? They're not going to be forgiven these debts. They're going to limit your period of payoff, the amortization time, to whatever's left on the cycle. That's really important. Okay, we come to this important word, surety. The Bible talks about surety, S-U-R-E-T-Y. What is surety, actually? This is kind of a big group here, but if anybody knows the answer, speak it up. Surety, in its first dictionary definition, is co-signing. It essentially means the collateral for your loan. Do you understand how co-signing works? Well, it's real simple. Let's just say that you guys are bankers again, and I'm coming to you for a loan. You type in my Social Security number, but this time comes up that I have four credit cards, and they're all maxed out, which means over my credit limit. That I've just had my car repossessed, which will show up on my credit card, and I'm 2 months behind in my house payment, and I'm currently unemployed. Now, would you give me a loan if you're a banker? No way, but see, you make your money on the interest, so bankers will say, if you could get your pastor or one of the elders of your church to come in, co-sign for you, then we will give you the loan. Now, do you understand how this works? I'm not credit worthy. They wouldn't touch me with a 10-foot pole. But if I can get one of you guys to come up and sign with me, and listen carefully, if you co-sign for someone, even though they get the money, that debt appears on your credit record until it's paid completely off. Now, something real interesting happens. The Bible says you should never co-sign for people. Did you hear the word I used? You should never co-sign for people. Now, Proverbs 6 says it. Another place in Proverbs has even more to say about it, but this is Proverbs 6, 1 to 5. Now, let me give you another interesting situation. Some people are so brash that they will come to you, a fellow church member, and ask you to co-sign for them. And then they're going to make you feel like a heel or a hypocrite if you won't do it. You say you're a Christian, I need the money, you won't co-sign for me. I'm going to pay it off, you don't have to pay it off. Guess what? Most of the time people co-sign, they get to pay it off to save their own credit. You should never do it. Now, I'm going to ask you a real personal question. What about co-signing for your kids? Co-signing for your kids. Let me give you an illustration so you understand what I mean. When my son Andrew was 16, just before his 16th birthday, he took driver training and did really well with it and enjoyed it. And he passed the course and he went and took his driver's test and got his driver's license. Then he came to me and he says, Dad, now that I've got my driver's license here, don't you think I need a car? Because, you know, you have to take me to work. And by the way, he worked at Taco Bell. You guys have Taco Bells up here? Well, Andrew worked at Taco Bell for 3 years, so I would expect him to be an expert about this. So he's told me two things about Taco Bell that you should know. We still eat there, so it's not bad. The first one is, if you show up on time for work at Taco Bell for 3 days in a row, they want to make you manager. This is important stuff, okay? That's one. Another one is they only have 12 food items there, and whatever you order, it's a combination of one of those things. Do you understand? My daughter, Melissa, worked at Burger King when she was in high school. We lived near the Academy campus, but since our kids didn't live in the dorm, the Academy couldn't provide the jobs for all the village students, you understand? So they worked at this fast food place. And I was been raised vegetarian my whole life, and we've raised our children vegetarian, but I was kind of a little bit apprehensive when I sent them to work at these fast food places because they both serve meat. Now, this is important, what I'm going to tell you next. Both of my children are young adults, independent, and they're more vegetarian than ever now, having worked at those two places. I'm telling you the actual truth. It's absolute fact. Anyway, Andrew said to me, you know, who's going to give me a loan for a car because I just work at Taco Bell? I mean, it's minimum wage. Every time you go to a fast food place, it's going to be some kid saying, welcome to McDonald's, could I take your order, please, right? Because no person with any personal responsibility could afford to work there unless they're the manager. It's either a senior citizen trying to supplement his Social Security or it's a kid, right? So he says, you know, who's going to give me a loan? But he says, Dad, if you will co-sign for me, I will make every payment. And then he looked me right in the eyes and he says, you know I'll do it, don't you? I said, I know you would. But he said, you're not going to, are you? I said, no. I said, the Bible says you should never do it. That's what you have to tell people that come and ask you to co-sign for them. This is your answer. The Bible, go home and read Proverbs 6, 1 to 5, and then you think whether you can ask me or not. But Andrew didn't take no for an answer. He looked at me and he says, Daddy, did your dad co-sign for you when you got your first car? I said, yes, but he didn't know any better. And I do. So I said to him this interesting thing. I said, Andrew, I'll tell you what we'll do. You save up half of the money that you want for your car, and I will give you the other half. And then I told him, now, if you buy a car for $400, you have to push it more than you ride in it. So, I mean, you're going to have to get something that's pretty substantial. Well, he took me serious, and he found a car for $3,000. And he came to me, and he says, Dad, I've got my $1,500. Where's yours? So he was pretty serious about it. But you get the point, surety. Now we're going to look at another one here. If surety is co-signing, what is personal surety? Have you ever thought about this word, personal surety? I'm going to give you the best illustration that I can of this. Personal surety is the difference between what you owe on something and what it is actually worth. Almost everyone who is making time payments on an automobile owes more on it than it's worth. Do you believe I'm telling you the truth about this? Okay. Making time payments on a car, sell it, you can't get enough out of it to pay the loan off. That's why many, many car dealers advertise today, trade in your car, we'll pay off the loan for you. Sounds like fun, doesn't it? Except they tack it onto your new loan. You understand? It stretches it out a lot longer and so on. That's what personal surety is. Okay, we're going to go on really quickly, and I want you to see this interesting statement that I found in Volume 6 of the Testimonies, page 448. There are only two places in the world where we can deposit our treasures, in God's storehouse or in Satan's, and all that is not devoted to Christ's service is counted on Satan's side and goes to strengthen his cause. Now, this is pretty heavy, as we say, because I'm going to ask you a question right now. If you get a $100,000 loan for a mortgage on a house, when you pay it back over 30 years to the bank, how much do you actually give back to the bank? Does anybody have an idea? It's about three times the amount, almost $300,000. Now, $200,000 of that then is interest, isn't it? Does that go to strengthen God's cause any? No. And no self-respecting Adventist Christian would ever sit down and write a check to the devil for $200,000. I mean, that just wouldn't happen. But the fact is, if the devil can keep us in debt for long periods of time, he siphons off huge portions of our income that cannot be used to help others or help advance the cause of God, are the only two things that do what? Store up treasures in heaven. We talked about that earlier. Okay, now here's the real interesting thing. You don't have this in your book, so I'm going to turn around and look at it. And you only need to see the big print anyway. This is something, nowadays we get these credit card offers in the mail. But a few years ago, these things kept coming in the mail. And I just want to show you what to look for. Have any of you heard the expression, smelling a rat? Is that something you remember? Okay, I want to ask you if you smell a rat here. This is when I lived down in Georgia in 1989. It says, quick money. You select the amount you want by checking the appropriate box. So you check $5,000, $4,000, or $3,100. Do you smell a rat yet? Where is it? It's right there. See that $100 there? Anybody who has a logical mind would think $5,000, $4,000. What's the next number? $3,000. Why does it say $3,100? That's the rat. That's the hidden catch that most people don't see. The fact is that in the United States, under the Uniform Commercial Code, it is illegal to charge high interest on loans of $3,000 or below. And the government put these in effect ostensibly to help poor people. So if they can get you to borrow $3,100, that law doesn't apply to them, so they can charge you 19% interest. Isn't that incredible? That's one of the rats. The other rat is right there. And this is called credit life insurance. You likely can't see it where you are, so it's $295.47 for a credit life insurance policy. And most people would say, well, listen, if I had that much ready cash, I wouldn't be getting the loan to start with. I don't have the money. And they'll say, no problem. We didn't think you did. So what we're going to do is we're going to just give you $5,000, but we're going to charge you $5,295. That's how much you finance. So you pay the credit life insurance over 60 months also. Now, I'm going to give you four reasons right now why you should never buy credit life insurance. So if you're making notes, you ought to jot these down. Four reasons why you should never buy credit life insurance. This is really, really interesting stuff. You know what credit life insurance is, doesn't it? Don't you? If you have a loan and you buy credit life insurance, like if I borrowed $5,000 and I paid $295, almost $300 for this, if I died, that loan would get paid off. Does everybody understand that? So reason number one to not buy it is you have to die to win. Do you understand? If you just get sick or you lose your job, is it going to help you a bit? Not at all. You have to die to win. Now, there's another thing about credit life insurance, and that is that it is debt-specific. So if I have a student loan, a car loan, a furniture loan, a signature loan like this, and a house loan, how many credit life insurance policies do I need? One for every debt. Do you understand? Another thing is that it always has a declining value. This is number three. This is really, really important. And that is, let's just say that I made 59 of the 60 payments and I dropped dead. How much insurance would my family get? Only the last payment. And that is $131. So it has a declining value. Do you understand? Number four, it is the worst investment choice that you could make of any insurance known to man. That is, the cost of it to the benefit ratio is extremely expensive. And that's why unscrupulous car salesmen, I saw a Hispanic couple who came to me for counseling. They barely understood English. They went to buy a Dodge van from a reputable, so-called well-known company advertised on TV and so on, a large city in the South. And these people were sold a Dodge van, just a window van, it wasn't a fixed up camper type or anything, for the full sticker price, and they charged both husband and wife credit life insurance $1,500 apiece. This is incredible stuff. These people are not your friends. You must understand that. So you need to know before you go that you're not going to buy credit life insurance. Now, if you think you need life insurance and you are in debt and you have a young family and so on, what kind of insurance should you get? Just a simple term policy. That's all. for the period of, say, 20 years or whatever. You pay a low premium. Full amount is always available should you die. Do you understand? That's a simple, much better thing to do. Okay, let me just show you these things. The borrower is the slave of the lender. This is just a review. Another one, this has been the curse of your life, Ellen White says, getting into debt, avoid it as you would the smallpox. Now, this guy here does not have freckles. What he has is smallpox, okay? Now, when Ellen White was writing years ago, smallpox was one of the most dreaded diseases known to man. For almost every person, if you got it, what was the prognosis? Death. She also says, avoid it as you would leprosy and avoid it as you would the plague. If she were alive and writing today, what do you think she would put there? Probably AIDS. Avoid debt like AIDS. Pretty serious stuff. Okay. And Romans 13, verse 8, let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing debt to love one another. Now we're going to talk about this interesting one because this sets us up for the three-step plan of getting out of debt. When one becomes involved in debt, he is in one of Satan's nets, which he sets for souls. Deny yourself 1,000 things rather than to run into debt. Big time stuff. This is Adventist Home 392 and 393. So we're going to look now at the three-step plan of getting out of debt, and I'm going to put them all up there at once so that if you don't have the book, you'll be able to write them down somewhere. Let me just tell you that hundreds of Adventist families have gotten out of debt using this principle. I learned this from Christian Financial Concepts, but as I can show you in just a moment, Ellen White wrote these three principles on one page of The Spirit of Prophecy more than 50 years before Larry Brackett was born. So this is important to understand. It's inspired what I'm going to tell you next. Here's what happens. I'm gone usually for about 6 camp meetings every summer, and when I come back after a week or 10 days away, my secretary has my mail stacked up and my magazine stacked up and these callback things. A lot of people send emails now, but when they call for me, she'll make a notation of when they called and what their phone number is. And she says, Elder Reed, this lady has called every day this past week, and every time she gets me on the phone, she starts crying. And I don't know what to do with her, and she wants to talk to you. Would you be willing to call her back first? So I called this lady back. And as soon as I got her on the phone, guess what she did? She started crying. And when she stopped crying, I said to her, what could I help you with today? She says, we're in deep debt. In fact, she said, we just returned this morning from an attorney's office, and he says, our only hope is to declare bankruptcy. But we just don't think that's the Christian thing to do, do you? And I said, well, not if you can help it. And I said, what's the nature of your debt? She says, we owe over $300,000. And so I thought, I didn't tell her this, but I thought, I bet these people bought themselves a big fine house, maybe more than they could afford, and this is going to be real simple. I'm just going to say, sell your house and move into a townhouse for a while until you can get back on your feet, and that's going to be the end of it. So I said to her, how much is the $300,000, how much of that is your home mortgage? And she said, we don't own our home, we're renting. So I said, what is the nature of the debt then? And she said, well, we were kind of in business for ourselves for a little while, and we had some employees and so on, and most of the debt, or the big third at the top, is taxes that we owe the government, income taxes and withholding tax for our employees that we haven't paid them into the IRS. And the second part is student loans, professional loans for my husband and I to go through graduate school, she said. And the third section was credit cards, that they had, you know, spent money on credit cards. And I said, did the attorney tell you that if you filed for bankruptcy protection, you could discharge your credit cards likely, but any taxes you owe the government or student loans of the type you have are not dischargeable in bankruptcy. You still owe all that debt, and yet you have the bankruptcy mark on your record for 10 years. And on your personal character for the rest of your life. So I asked this lady a simple question. I said, you've called me for free professional Christian advice, so I get to ask you a question. Have you guys been tithing? What do you think she said? She said, no, we can't afford to. And I said, how do you expect God to bless your family if you are robbing him? Now, the reason I told you that story is because before the three steps will work here, the basic premise is you establish the tithe. And there's so many places, Proverbs 3, Deuteronomy 28, Malachi 3, Matthew 6, Matthew 25, all of these of God's promised blessings to those who are faithful. It's incredible when you think about it. And you can see there. By the way, do you remember when you read Malachi 3, it says you're cursed with a curse, even this whole nation? You've never heard a sermon in the Adventist church, and you never will hear one, and I'm sure not going to give you one on what the curses are, but would you like to know where to find them? You can read them for yourself in the Bible. It's Deuteronomy chapter 28, verses 15 to 68. That means there's 43 verses. Did I say that right? 53 is the right number. 53 verses of curses. Chapter 28, verses 15 to 63. There's 68 verses. Now, here's these three things. Once you establish the tithe, you can expect God to bless you. But here's the steps of getting out of debt. The first one is you declare a moratorium on additional debt. That means no more credit spending. This is really, really interesting stuff. You're not going to do anything more on credit. The second one is that you make a covenant with God. Now, what is a covenant actually? It's a promise or an agreement. So I can tell you, I'm going to have to be real specific about my own situation. And that is in April of 1987, when Kathy and I learned about this, we knelt down beside of our bed. We were living in Calhoun, Georgia. And we said, God, we don't think it's honoring you for us to be paying all this interest. So we're going to make a promise to you. Any extra income we get from any source, it will go on our debts until they're all paid off, in addition to our regular payments. Do you understand? That's the covenant. It's a promise. Now, let me just tell you something very interesting. What does the average person do with any extra money they get? What usually happens? They just spend it. They splurge. A man told me one time, he says, you can use this as an illustration, and I usually do. It's a large church in the South. And when I said this, a man raised his hand and he said, well, I know that's true. We got $2,500 we weren't expecting. And I said to my wife, how did God know we needed a new riding lawnmower? And he just went out and bought one. You know, that's the way it goes usually. Now, listen carefully. If you have made the covenant that any extra money you get will go on debts, God will be free to bless you. Do you think he wants your family in debt? No way. Do you think, if you've made the covenant, that there's the slightest possibility that God may help you get out of debt? I was at the Hagerstown, Maryland church, a large church, just a few months ago. It's probably been a year and a half now, I guess, holding my finance seminar like this. And usually it's Friday night and Sabbath school time and church time and in the afternoon. And a man came up to me after Friday night meeting. He says, I won't be here tomorrow. But he says, I drove down from somewhere up in Pennsylvania just to see you tonight when I heard you were going to be here, because you did a seminar that I attended about 4 years ago. And my wife and I bought your book, and we decided to put this stuff into practice. And we've just made the last payment on our house, and we are totally debt-free. We don't owe anybody anything. And I just wanted to shake your hand, he said. Now, what I'm telling you, these principles work. There's no question about it. And I'm going to show you how to do it in just a minute. So first you declare a moratorium. Then you make a covenant with God that you're not going to, any extra money is going to go on your debts. Then number three, I'm going to illustrate this. You list your debts from the largest to the smallest in descending order. And it would look like this. Now, please don't be upset about seeing a triangle. This has nothing to do with the Illuminati or A.L. Williams or anything. This is just a little illustration that I put together, okay? Now, you can see this here. The home mortgage for most people is their largest debt, or a line of credit on their house, or student loans, or whatever. But you list the largest debt at the top, and your home mortgage should be up there whether it's the largest or not. But at any rate, you list them in descending order. Would anybody guess why I put Visa at the bottom? The real answer is the smallest word. It just fit in there better, okay? Now, usually your credit cards have high interest, But I want you to listen carefully to how this works, is it will work for you and it will be really fun for you to do. The reason that you don't pay your house off first is because it's the biggest one and you wouldn't be able to sing the victory song very often. Does that make sense? In addition to that, the interest that you do pay is tax deductible. So why pay that one off first? When you, tomorrow afternoon likely, we're going to talk about the how to pay your house off. And I told you earlier today, I can show you how you can make 8 years worth of house payments without spending any more money than you typically spend in 1 year. Would you like to know how to do that? This is awesome stuff. I can just tell you that we had our house paid off in Georgia, but when we moved to Washington, D.C., housing is like 3 times more expensive. But we had to get a mortgage again. But by the grace of Almighty God, we have 8 payments left, and it's going to be paid off because we work on it. Well, this is, we practice what we preach. Do you understand? This is important stuff. Okay, now listen, you have to make the minimum payment due on every payment every month. Now, I'm going to tell you a little story right now. It's only a 2-sentence one or so. But listen, you can go all the way through elementary school, academy, and college and never be required to take a course that will teach you how to buy an insurance policy, how to balance your checkbook, how to buy an automobile, or how to buy a house. Is that true or not? So how do people learn this stuff? We call it trial and error, and lots of both. Unless your parents or somebody knows how to do it and they taught you how. Because people go through all kinds of problems. So I'm going to tell you what happened to me recently. A lady came to me and she waited until last to talk to me after the seminar. And she says, Elder Reed, she says, I feel so stupid. She said, I did not realize until today in your seminar. And she says, I'm the manager of our family, like my wife Kathy is in our family. She said, I did not realize until today that you could make more than the minimum payment on your credit card. That's what she told me. Now, she's a smart woman, but no one had ever told her, and it somehow had not occurred to her. Your goal, of course, is to pay it off every month in total, right? Let me give you a couple of illustrations about this so that you can understand what I mean by it. If you only make the minimum payment on a credit card debt and you never use the card again as long as you live, how long would it take you to pay it off? Most of them are on a 15-year amortization. And listen, some companies are unscrupulous. Sears is a good example of this. They've been to big lawsuits up in New England for years now over this kind of stuff because they will send you a statement, and if for many families, if your balance is lower than $1,000, they will say none due. Has anybody ever gotten a statement from Sears that said none due? I've done that. None due. Even though you owe them money. It's like they're giving you another month free, right? No way. They're going to charge you the interest on it. I feel a story coming on, so I'm going to tell you one. Here it is. See Sears right here? By the way, I like to work on stuff, and I'm a pretty good mechanic, and I have a whole set of Craftsman tools, and I think they're pretty good tools for the average guy. But let me just tell you something. A lady came to my office one time. She was not an Adventist. She was sent there by Christian Financial Concepts because I'm a counselor with them. And she came to me, and she says, Brother Reed, she says, I'm just really deeply in debt. And she had all kind of serious problems. She'd been in an automobile accident and had, you know, financial problems with the hospital and all that stuff. And she says, I'm so deep in debt, I don't know what to do. She says, for example, I just sent Sears a payment today of $75. And that just pays the interest on what I owe them. Now, if you get them to work out a deal with you that you pay interest only, how long does it take you to pay off the debt? You never get it paid off. So I said, well, I have an idea. Why don't we call Sears and see if they would give you a period of time like a year at no interest so you can make headway on the principal? She says, oh, they'd never do that. Well, I learned something from my dad when I was a kid, and that is when you ask somebody a yes or no question, the worst I can say is no. Isn't that true? So I called Sears. I was in Georgia, so I called Sears' Southeastern credit manager, a guy named Pitchford, in Atlanta. And I said, I have a lady in my office that's at the point of bankruptcy. She said, some real difficulties. I had already asked her, any question about your bill? She said, oh, no, we put all that stuff on there. But I just don't know how I'm going to pay it back. So I said, Mr. Pitchford, would you be willing to withhold the finance charges on this account for a period of 1 year so that she can make headway on the principal? And Mr. Pitchford said to me, Mr. Reed, I don't think you know what you're asking me to do. I said, oh, yes, I do. I'm asking him again the same thing. He says, you don't understand. He told me this with his own mouth. Sears makes more profit on the interest charges on unpaid balances than it does on the profit margin on the sale of the merchandise. You're asking us to cut out our profit. And I said, Mr. Pitchford, I don't think you know what I'm asking you. He says, what do you mean? I said, I'm asking you, do you want the principal or nothing? The lady's about to go bankrupt. He says, now you speak my language. So he said, I'm going to make a note in the computer on her account, and there's going to be no finance charges for a period of 1 year with only one provision. And that is that she makes at least $75 a month payment on the principal. And she was willing to do that. About a year later, she called me back, and this time she called me Elder Reed. She says, Elder Reed, praise the Lord, I've paid Sears off. Well, they were tickled because they got the principal back. She was tickled because she got the debt paid off. That's what's called mitigating damage. It's not always possible, but you can do things like that sometimes. But you have to make the minimum payment on every debt. Now, here's the way this thing works. When you've made the minimum payment on every debt, the one at the bottom, any extra money you get out here from any source, you add to your minimum payment till you get that one paid off. And then you just delete it off. Does everybody see that? That's what happens. Then you can put the minimum payment you were making on Visa with your minimum payment on Sears, along with any extra money you get, and you can pay that one off, and you can sing the victory song again until you get up to your home mortgage, and tomorrow we'll talk about how to do that. That's the plan. Now let me show you something else interesting. This is what Ellen White said about this topic. This is on page 257 of Counsels on Stewardship. Be determined never to incur another debt. What does that sound like? Look at your first principle in the workbook. Moratorium on debt. Deny yourself 1,000 things rather than to run into debt. This has been the curse of your life, getting into debt. Avoid it as you would the smallpox. Then here comes principle number 2. Make a solemn covenant with God that by His blessing, you'll pay off your debts and then owe no man anything if you live on porridge and bread. Now in the South, we say grits and gravy. What do you guys say up here? Oatmeal or something? You understand? We're talking about basic stuff here anyway. Okay. Then the statement continues, do not falter, be discouraged, or turn back, deny your taste, deny the indulgence of appetite, save your pence, pay your debts, and then the third principle, right there, work them off as fast as possible. And when you can stand forth a free man again, owing no man anything, you will have achieved a great victory. And everybody said, amen. So that's the idea, being out of debt. Now, I'm going to put all of these up here at once for the benefit of some of you who may not have the workbook. You'll be able to see them here. There's 6 things that I suggest to people in addition to the 3 steps. 3 steps have to be in place with the basic premise. Establish the tithe, and then no more credit spending. Make the covenant, work them off as fast as possible. But here they are. The first one, establish a budget. Now I'm going to show you a simple budget in just a few minutes. But when we say establish a budget, what do we really mean by that? That means have a simple budget. Most people like budgets about as much as they like dieting. You understand? And do you think most people have budgets that they actually go on? No, they just live from paycheck to paycheck and pay whatever squeaks the loudest. So I'm going to tell you, have a simple budget. The next one is set goals for your family. And that means, for example, here's a goal. Some people have been around for 30 years, but they live the same year of their life every year, and they really have no experience. Do you understand? But you just say, for example, by the end of next year, we're going to have the car paid off, period. Whatever it takes, we're going to pay that car off. Do you understand? That's a goal. Or a goal would be, we're going to save up money for our vacation. We're not going to use our credit card at all. Or we're going to have the money in the bank to pay the card off when we get back, or something like that. Do you understand? That's a goal. Okay. Number 3 is destroy credit cards. And then I have a little word here, if. Do you see that? Destroy credit cards if. And the if is you don't pay it off every month. And the second one is you find yourself buying stuff just because you have the credit card. You understand that you're misusing your credit. Now, I'm going to tell you something interesting. A lady came to me one time at one of my seminars, and she said, what's the interest rate on your credit card? And I said to her, very honestly, I don't even know. I don't even care, because I don't pay any. Do you understand? You pay it off every month. I get my credit card for other reasons, benefits to me. So I'll give you an illustration. We were going to replace a General Motors car. And so a few years ago, GM came out with a GM MasterCard. You remember that? And every time you used your card, whatever the total was, 5% of that would be given to you as a credit in a little bank somewhere in Detroit, probably. And what's going to happen is when you go to buy your car, they'll type it in and see what your credit is. Listen carefully. They've wised up since those days, but they didn't put any limit on its use. We used that credit card for everything. We actually paid our kids' tuition at Andrews University at $1,500 a shot using a credit card, but we paid it back. Why send them a check when we can put it through the credit card? You understand? So when we got ready to buy our car, by the way, I wish I had time to tell you how to buy a car. This is really fun. I'll give you the illustration of this one incident. You don't ever go to the car lot and fall in love with some car. They're going to figure out some way to get you in it. You understand that, don't you? So what I did is I researched the kind of a car that I wanted, and I knew all of the numbers of the things that I wanted on it. And instead of going and talking to some plaid-coated green pants salesperson at the car dealership, I just faxed it to the sales manager for 5 different dealerships. This is what I want. Fax me back what you'll sell it to me for. And in a day or so, and they're all interested, I got faxes back. And 4 of them were almost within $100 of each other. But one guy was $1,500 less than the others. That's where I bought it. They're all made on the same assembly line. Any GM dealership in the United States will service it and so on. It happened to be a Suburban. And so when I went to get the Suburban, I asked the man, you know, I'm really happy that I got such a good deal. He says, well, I'm glad that I was able to sell another one, because if I didn't got one more sale this year of that vehicle, then I wouldn't have been getting my quota to order a number back next year. So he was happy and I was happy. Do you understand? Without any dickering of any kind. But when I went there, I said, now I want to apply my GM credit. So, no problem. What's your credit card number? And I gave it to him. And I'm sitting on the other side of the computer. You guys can't see my laptop up here. It's kind of like that. So he's typing in his, my credit card number, and this thing pops up, and he says, that couldn't be right. So he rebooted the program and got it back up and typed my number in again. Same result. It says here $4,100 credit. And he says, that couldn't be right. And I said, well, I called him right before I came over here, and that's what they told me I had. And he said, you're the highest award winner in the history of Fox Chevrolet in Laurel, Maryland. But I got the money. Do you understand? The credit off the cost. Guess what? When we got home, we closed the account. We've never used it again, because we used it for that one reason. What I use now is a United Airlines Visa so that I can get free travel, so that I could take my wife with me free to South Africa for our 35th anniversary while we're at the camp meeting down there. Do you understand? That's how things work. Do it to your advantage, not theirs. They don't like that. Do you understand? The point is, it works for you. All right. Another one is purchase depreciating items with cash. What are depreciating items? Well, this is not a fair question. It would be much easier to say, what isn't depreciating, right? So in general, you know, real estate and things like that, typically they will escalate in value unless you own property in Los Angeles right after the earthquake. You understand? Those are kind of things that are pretty serious. Purchase depreciating items with cash. By the way, people are bold enough to ask me at times, do I practice what I preach? And the answer is yes. So for the last 2 vehicles that we have purchased, we paid cash for them. Do you know what the downside is to paying cash for a car? Does anybody know? There's actually 2 of them that I've encountered. One of them that you have to know first aid to revive or resuscitate the dealer when he asks you, how are you planning to pay? And you know, you've got this plan and this plan and this plan and this plan and leasing, which you should never do unless you have a business that can write it off. And he says, which plan would you like? And I said, well, I was planning to write a check for it. Would that be okay? So he faints out of his chair, and you go and pat him on the head and pour some cold water on him, and he gets back up in there. Then he tries to talk you out of it. Did you hear what I said? He tries to talk you out of it because they make money on the financing. Really serious. Let me tell you one other thing about buying a car. Once you've struck the deal that you like, never pay the dealership another cent. They're going to send you in to the person that types it all up, and that person is going to send you undercoating and all kind of burglar alarms and special treatments on the paint and all that stuff, which you can get aftermarket much cheaper. Do you understand? But you, some people spend $3,000 or $4,000 after they buy the car. That's what you need to be really wary of. Okay. Let's go on. Number five here, begin economy measures. Everybody knows how to begin economy measures, don't you? Don't go shopping for groceries when you're hungry, you know, those kind of things. Buy things on sale. Okay. Now, my favorite one of all of these here is number six, and that is have a sale. Ellen White says an interesting statement, and you may want to write it down there. It's in Counsels on Stewardship, page 60. And she says, as we near the close of time, we should be divesting ourselves of our assets so not much of our stuff gets burned up at the end. Does that make sense to anybody? Instead of accumulating more stuff. So I'm going to ask you a question now that's really fun. This is a true confession question type. How many of you think that you might have stuff in your possession that you will never use again as long as you live? Would anybody be willing to raise your hand on that? Okay, we're pretty much unanimous here. You guys are pretty honest in Michigan. Let me just tell you something. When Kathy and I were in this debt reduction mode while we were living in Georgia, Kathy suggested that we have a yard sale. Now, we had never had a yard sale before because when are most of them held? On Sabbath, right? God's going to have to make this up to us when we get to heaven. We've missed out on a whole lot for honoring the Sabbath. I'm teasing you, of course. Anyway, we lived in Calhoun, Georgia when we had our one and only yard sale. Now, have you ever heard that the South is the Bible Belt? Has anybody ever heard that expression? Well, in Gordon County, Georgia, where we live, the wonderful place to live, and I have nothing disparaging to say about it in any way, but there, at that time, there was one Adventist church in the county, and there were 87 Baptist churches. You could not be more than 2 miles from a Baptist church anywhere in Gordon County. Now, that's why it's called the Bible Belt. So Kathy and I were naive for several reasons. First of all, I said, well, it's a good idea. I know we've got junk that we've never used since we've been here. We lived here a long time. And the kids had stuff they weren't using anymore, so we were going to have this big yard sale. But I said, where are Christians supposed to live? Out in the country. Remember we talked about that last night in the meeting some? So we live out in the country. We have 17 acres. It's a wooded property and you can't see our house from the road or anything. And I thought we're going to have to pack up all this stuff and haul it in a trailer up to the Kmart parking lot, sit out in the hot sun and have people come by and look at our junk. Oh, she says, no, people come right to your house. And I said, our house? She said, yeah, I'll just put a little directions with the ad. So she put the directions in and the fact that we're having a yard sale on Sunday. We thought, naively, that means without knowledge, that these people would all go to church on Sunday, go out to eat, visit with friends, and maybe come to our house sometime in the afternoon. So Saturday night, we got all this stuff together. We put the cars out of the garage and filled our garage with junk. Did you hear the word I said? With junk. Okay. We got tired, frankly, and we said, Kathy says, the way you do this is you take a little piece of masking tape and tear it off and put it on each item and then write on that with a magic marker what the price is. We'd never done this before, so it was an experiment for us. It was kind of interesting. So we went to bed, though, Saturday night without pricing anything because we were going to get up early in the morning. We always get up early every morning. Sunday is the only morning we sleep in. We once slept in as late as 7 o'clock, and I'm not kidding you, on Sunday morning. But most of the time, we're up about 5:30. And so we get up about 7, and this is the morning, if I'm home, that we have waffles. And in those days, I didn't travel as much. You know, we have what we call a farmer's breakfast, you know, a real sure enough breakfast. And I rarely miss breakfast. In my whole life, I rarely miss breakfast. But when I got up at 7 o'clock, I walked out of my house with just Bermuda shorts on, no shirt, no shoes and socks. And there were already cars in the driveway. I think there were four cars there already. And the lady that was in first position had brought her pillow and she was sound asleep. I don't know when she came, but she was going to be the first one to see our junk. It's so funny to me to remember that. So I ran back in the house and I said to my wife, her name is Kathy and I call her Kat. I said, Kat, get up. There's people out there already. So we missed breakfast. Did you hear what I said? We missed breakfast. And we went out there, we're frantically putting prices on things, and finally people were getting out of their car because they could see us moving around through the windows of our garage door. So we opened them up and people started buying stuff. Now here comes the good part. Mid-afternoon sometime, there were just a few items left. And some guy came out, no one else was there, some guy showed up in a pickup truck. And he looked around a little bit and he got a couple of things and the price was about $5. And I said to him, is that all you want? And he said to me, that's all the money I've got. And I thought to myself, I know that guy's lying. He's got more money than that. So I said to him, I'm going to make you a deal, my friend. I will let you have everything that's left for another $5. And he says, sold, and he gave me a $10 bill. Isn't that amazing? Now, what do you think he did with this stuff? He didn't even want it. He took it to another yard sale. Sure, that's what they do all the time, I guess. Now, here comes the neat part. This was not a major thing with us. I'm just telling you because it's kind of a funny experience. We made $265 in our yard sale. We didn't tithe it because we were selling everything at a loss that we had bought with tithed money. Does everybody understand that? So what we did, though, is we took $20 and went to Taco Bell and had a vegetarian burrito, supper, and drinks for all four people in our family. We did that. But on Monday morning, I invested the $245 and made 2,700% interest in one day. Tomorrow, if you come, I'm going to show you how I did that. It's really amazing. You'll see. It's pretty interesting stuff. Okay. We're going to go now real quickly. What do we have? 10 more minutes? Okay. Let me put all of these up here so that if you're doing this, you can do this. The big question is how much is enough? People come to me for counseling sometimes and they say, well, we make a pretty good income, but we just don't know where the money goes. And I've told people like that, well, do you think somebody's stealing from you or something? And they said, oh, no, well, the fact is you have to have a simple budget. That's the point. Okay? How much is enough? Here's another kind of a truism statement. Most families will spend everything they make no matter how much it is. Do you believe that's true? Yeah? It's amazing. So you have to determine how much does it really take for your family to exist. And then if more comes in, maybe God is asking you to store up treasures in heaven. And we do that by helping others and helping advance the cause of God. Some of you here have been treasures at your local church. And there's not one of you that's ever seen a check coming into the offering plate that was signed by God. It's always through people who've been blessed by God. Do you understand? And they have those blessings they're willing to share. And that's what it's about. So a budget is simply counting the cost. What is the income flow? How much are our expenses? And so on. Now I'm going to show you about the proper uses of money here. And this one is a quote from Christ Object Lessons. The only thing I've done is put those little hyphens in there, but this is a direct quote, Christ Object Lesson 351. Money has great value because it can do great good. But money is of no more value than sand, only as it is put to use in these three things. Providing for the necessities of life, in blessing others, and in advancing the cause of Christ. Now, if you're a student of the Spirit of Prophecy, and I like to study the Spirit of Prophecy a lot, and I have the CD right here on my computer, and I can just tell you something amazing. Ellen White mentions the true value of money probably a dozen times in her writings. She says it in different ways, but always there's only three uses, and they're always in that order. Now, I want you to understand something significant about this. What does God put first? Your family's needs. Doesn't want to take clothes off your back or food out of your mouth. He says, take care of your needs. Then, as you have extra, bless others. And that could be in offering monies or helping Adra or your next door neighbor, advancing the cause of God, hope for, you know, the homeland, whatever it might be. Does everybody understand that? That's what it is. Now, I've said this before, but if it takes everything I make just to do this, how much am I storing up in heaven? You understand? That's pretty serious when you think about the consequences. So, if you have the workbook or the textbook, it's your money book. I don't know what page this is on, but it's the next page. Does anybody tell me what page it is? 18? Okay. This is what you're going to see. Now, my suggestion to you is if you have the workbook, don't write on this page. As I talk, don't try to take notes here. And the reason is very simple. You need to actually take this to your work or to a library or someplace and photocopy this page and the next page, which looks like this. That's the worksheet there. It's going to be too small for most of you to read where you're sitting, but that's the worksheet. Now, what I'm going to tell you is it will take you several attempts to make a budget if you're not on one. So do it in pencil till you get it finally done, and then you can finally write it in an ink pen. Okay? Now, I'm going to show you some things here that are very, very important. And don't think about the $30,000 income or the $15,000 income. This budget was put together by Christian Financial Concepts maybe 15 years ago. But here's the point. The money is absolutely immaterial. There's not one couple in here that has exactly the same income as any other couple. Do you understand? What you're looking at is this line right there. And that's the percentage that I want you to think about. In most cases, you're going to talk about that kind of a line right there. So what you think about is I'm going to show you first thing how to look at this. We're not going to spend a lot of time on this because you'll do it later on your own. But when you get your income totaled, what is the first check you write? Tithe and offerings, right? So in this relatively low income in today's economy, I put 12% there. That would be tithe plus 2% offerings. Does everybody see that? Many people, I mean, like Kathy and I have been doing 10 plus 10 almost our whole married life. And in fact, we just did our taxes, of course, a few months ago, as most of you did. And the amazing thing is, I think this last year was 28%. I don't even know how we did it. But it's incredible. And I did it on TaxCut, which is a computer program. H&R Block, I think, does part of that. And when I was doing it in the typewriter or in my computer, it's up on the screen, had this little tutor thing. And I typed in the amount of our contributions. And my computer started going beep, beep, beep. And it says, are you sure about this? You know? And I had to manually enter it to make it do the program because it's more than what most people do. But as Adventists, we understand God blesses us. So at any rate, I put 12% up here. And then this next one is 21%. That's tithe, taxes, state and federal, and so on. I was at a workers' meeting some time ago where there's a group of pastors. And in the lunch line while we're waiting for dinner, one of the pastors was telling another pastor about a book he had just read that said income taxes are unconstitutional. Have anybody here ever heard that before? Okay, you understand what I'm talking about. He said he had just read this book. There was no mandate in the Constitution for income tax. And he was trying to encourage his friend to join him in stopping paying taxes. So I came up and whispered to this guy in his ear and I said, my friend, never say another word about that as long as you live. He looked at me so funny. I said that just to make a point. I was kind of teasing him a little bit. And he said, what are you talking about? I said, I bet you read one of those books about not paying taxes, didn't you? I said to him, are you aware that most people that write those kind of books write their second book from jail? And I said, I want to tell you another little story. You may not be old enough to understand this, but years ago in the 20s, there was a gangster named Al Capone. You ever heard of him? We understand today, using forensic evidence that's available to us as attorneys and to law enforcement, that he was likely responsible for the death of at least 54 people. By any standard, he was a mass murderer. Why did he spend the last part of his life in jail? Tax evasion. Do you understand? Constitutional or not, it's enforced in the United States. And somewhere in the Bible, I read, render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar and to God the things that are God's. Now, anybody who has a lick of sense ought to try to get all the deductions that they have due them. Do you understand? But it is not appropriate for a Christian to try to cheat his country. This is important to understand. So you take your tithe and offerings and taxes. In this case, is a huge chunk. It's 33%. That leaves 67% to become this thing right here, which we call net spendable income. That's the amount you make your budget on. And you have here 10 categories. And that's housing and food and auto and, you know, insurance, debts, etc. You can read all of that. And then you just assign a percentage to each one of those categories. I remember being at Christian Financial Concepts headquarters in Gainesville, Georgia one day, picking up some workbooks. I used to do their seminar, Your Finances in Changing Times, and I would buy like 3,000 workbooks at a time. And I was there one day buying some supplies, and there was Larry Baquette behind this glass with the red lights at on air, and the radio program that they have, their half-hour program, was being broadcast out in the shipping department. And some lady had called in from California, and she said, Larry, that budget you have is absolutely crazy. For 30% of your income to go for housing? I mean, what kind of a house can you get for 30% in California? I knew what she was talking about because I had just been out to Southern California and given this seminar to the Southern California workers. And when I talked about this and I put this up there and they saw $503, everyone began laughing. And so at lunchtime, the pastors decided to compare notes and to see who had the cheapest house payment or rent of anybody there. And it turned out to be some intern just out of the seminary, and his bill that he was paying was $1,235 a month for rent in California. So I told them this story. By the way, let me just show you something interesting. That's not just your house payment when you talk about housing. We're talking about insurance, taxes, all of your utilities, including your telephone. And you say, oh, this is so goofy. But Larry said to this lady, well, how much of your income do you need? She said, well, at least 40%. And he said, well, this is just a guideline suggested budget. Put whatever percent you want to there. So she wrote right here, crossed out 30 and put 40%. And as they went on down through the line on this national radio call-in program, she was changing every percent. And finally he said, now please take a pen and draw a line right there and add up those 10 figures. And she had 160%. The problem is, you only have 100% to spend. And if you spend more than that, you're going into debt. What would you tell someone like that? Well, what he said to her was, ma'am, you cannot afford to live in California on your income. You should move to Georgia. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later in the week. Okay, now, does everybody understand this? You can figure it out yourself. We're not going to spend a great deal of time on it. Okay, I'm going to show you one other thing. One of the things you did not see on that, which is on the new budget that Christian Financial Concepts has done, is Christian education. And everybody here who's my age or younger or maybe older knows the cost of Christian education. It's very expensive. Both of my kids attended Andrews University, and I can tell you when they were there, it's $15,000 a year. Get a 40-year degree, you just spent $60,000. Do you want to know something else interesting? A large percentage, more than half, of college graduates end up not working in the field for which they were trained. You understand what I'm talking about? Graduate with English major or something, and you do something completely different. The reason I'm telling you that is if you have children who are getting ready for academy or college, have them tested. In fact, Christian Financial Concepts has a whole testing battery that you can find out what your aptitude is, whether you should get into science, humanities, whatever it is. And we had our kids tested. So we wanted to know that if we spent $60,000 apiece, then we're going to end up working at McDonald's. Do you understand? This is important stuff. So Andrew took a dual major, history and English, because he was good in humanities. Kathy had read to our kids when they were young and so on. And he later went to law school and became an attorney, which were ideal for those, history and English. Do you see what I'm saying? And this is important. Same with Melissa. Well, the point I'm going to tell you is, you count the cost, though, but you have to do it 1 year at a time. And remember, what would it profit a man if he gained the whole world and lost his soul or the souls of his kids? Now listen carefully. I know I'm not trying to be emotional or dramatic at all, but if this were the last day on earth, no one would be happier than they would be if their spouse and their kids were with them ready to go to heaven, no matter what else they'd accomplished in this whole world. Isn't that true? You understand. So this is important. Christian education is expensive, but of course ignorance is more expensive. Now, we're going to go along with this. And I'll tell you one other thing. I'll show you how we did it here in just a minute. I want to talk to you briefly about student loans. I believe that student loans are valuable in some cases, but they should be the last resort. Did you hear the words I said? The last resort. Now, you go to a place, even unfortunately like Andrew's, and you go to the student aid office, and you submit your parents' 1040 IRS forms, and you talk about your family history and all the stuff you got and all of your assets and so on, and they're going to come out and they'll tell you, you qualify for a $10,000 loan. Guess how much that student's going to borrow usually? $10,000. Hit the whole thing out. My suggestion is borrow the least you can get by with. Why? Because you have to pay it back with interest. Do you know that you can amortize student loans over 30 years now? I mean, it's like a house payment. I had a lady come to me for counseling who was 67 years old, and she had gotten student loans for graduate work, and at age 67, she still owed more than $40,000 in student loans. And we're talking about this woman is not going to live long enough to pay this back. Do you understand? That's going to be a, you know, something, a weight around her neck her whole life. Incredible stuff people get involved in. So, I'm going to show you how to do it, how to minimize that. Here's the better way right here. It's not in the order that I will discuss it, because I'm going to talk about this one first. This is a secret among most Adventist families. People do not know this. But if you have children in the academy, if they do well in the academy, academically, like they're an A student, whatever, or if they get involved in student activities, like if they sing in the choir, they're in the tumbling team, they're the editor of the newspaper, or they're the president of their class, or something like that, they get points for that, and it gives them a scholarship, which means you don't have to pay it back when they go to an Adventist college. Do you understand what I'm telling you? I'll give you an example. I wish I could brag about your kids, but I don't know your kids, so I'll have to brag about mine. When my daughter, Melissa, went through elementary school and academy, she had a little friend, Joni Self, who's now a medical doctor, and she and Joni were buddies the whole time, and they were kind of competitive. They were best friends. They stayed at each other's house from time to time and so on. And they both made straight A's all the way through elementary school and academy. And so on graduation day at Georgia Cumberland Academy, Southern Adventist University had a representative there, and they were giving out scholarships to people. And most of them were $200 or $300, $500, whatever. And I was sitting there, of course, as a proud parent of Melissa, and I said to my wife, Kathy, they must have forgot about Melissa and Joni. She says, they're not done yet. And pretty soon they said, Melissa Reed and Joni Self, and those two girls went up, and they said, $2,000 scholarship for each of the 4 years of college. Of course, you have to go to college to get it. You don't get a check. And you have to keep your grades up to keep qualifying. You understand that. But a real interesting thing was, when we went out to the receiving line, when all the graduates still had their caps and gowns on out the sidewalk and we're shaking hands, when I came up to Melissa, I said, congratulations, Melissa, that's awesome. And she says, but Daddy, I wanted to go to Andrews University like Andrew did, and Joni wants to go to PUC, and these are for Southern. Well, I thought she should go to Southern because I graduated there, and I, you know, it was only 50 miles from home, but she wanted to go to Andrews, 600 miles away. So I said, let me tell you a little secret, honey. All 13 Adventist colleges will honor it. Joni got it at PUC, Melissa got it at Andrews University. Do you understand? You need to know that. Because if you have $15,000 to start with here and you take $2,000 a year off of it, you're already down to $13,000. Do you understand? It's important stuff. You don't have to pay it back. So I'm going to have to close here because we're done. But I realize I'm over 5 minutes and I'm sorry for that. I usually try to close right on time.
This media was produced by Hope Media Ministry. If you have been blessed by this media, you may want to consider a donation to help support our efforts to spread these important and timely messages. For this and other great witnessing material, please visit our media center at www.hopevideo.com. Our address is Hope Media Ministry, P.O. Box 752, ADA, Michigan, 49301. You can also email us at hope at hopevideo.com. Our media includes DVD, video, CD audio, and cassette. You can also listen to much of our media for free at our online media center at www.hopevideo.com. That's hopevideo.com.